This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Military families dread that knock on the door that brings the news a loved one has been killed in the war. For 3 years, Steve Beck was one of the Marines whose job was to deliver that news and to help the survivors get through the terrible period that followed. Beck was a major at the time. He's a colonel now. Colonel Beck is my guest, along with journalist Jim Sheeler. Sheeler's new book, Final Salute, is about Beck, the families he notified, and the loved ones they lost. Final Salute is an expansion of Sheeler's Pulitzer Prize-winning article, which he wrote for the Rocky Mountain News, where he spent 5 years covering the impact of the Iraq War at home. He begins teaching journalism at the University of Colorado in the fall. Colonel Beck is on a brief leave to enable him to go on a book tour with Sheeler. My first question is for Colonel Beck. In the 3 years that it was your job to knock on doors and deliver the news that someone's loved one had died in the war, did you learn what were the best ways of breaking the news, like phrases that you could use that would maybe soften things a little bit or convey the kind of emotion that you, or lack of emotion that you felt you needed to convey?
That's a very tough question. I don't know that I learned how to do that. I don't believe I learned how to take away emotion of the most horrible news that can be delivered to someone. It is wrought with emotion. What you must do is convey to them that their loved one has fallen, their loved one has died, and that you're there, that you have empathy for their pain, and you're there to care for them and to help guide them through what will prove to be some of the most difficult days of their lives. And so you go with an empathetic heart, but at the same time you go standing as strong as you can so that you can be their oak and they can lean on you in the times that will come, which will be some of the most difficult times for them.
Being there to lean on is actually part of the job. How long are you expected to remain close to a family and be there to support them?
I don't think we have established a set time for that. That really comes down to the relationship that is formed between a family and a casualty officer or a fellow Marine. They know you're a Marine. They know you're trying to take care of them. They know you're there for them. If relationships form between casualty officers and family members, they could last for years. Or if they don't form in those times of adversity that they're going through, they may dissolve when your duty is completed and you've taken care of the family as much as you can.
Do the families often know what the news is going to be as soon as they see you?
I think so. It's my belief that when they see us at the door, that they know that something bad has happened. And they all know that their loved one's serving in combat. And we just don't go make house visits. So if we're standing in there in front of their door, I think they always know that something very bad has happened.
Yeah, they're instructed in their – this is Jim. They're instructed before their service member leaves that if their loved one is injured, then they'll get a phone call. And the only way that they will know that if they've died is that if they get a personal visit. And I mean, I've talked to mothers and wives who – I mean, they'll – circle the street two or three times, just kind of eyeing in front of their house, looking for that government van, looking for things that aren't right, because they know that if it's there, then the worst has happened. And they try to put it off as much as they can, put it out of their minds, but it's always there.
You're there in part to help the person to whom you're delivering the news. You're there to deliver it and to help them. But when they see you and they figure out why you're there, you're the symbol of the worst thing that could happen. And I guess I'm wondering what it's like to knock on a door knowing that you are going to initially be that symbol?
Well, the way I've come to terms with that, for me, for personally, I know that I'm delivering the worst news that they could possibly hear. And it's incredibly painful for me. But what drives me forward is knowing this the pain that they're going to go through cannot even possibly be compared with the minimal pain and discomfort I'm feeling. And so I can put mine aside quite easily, knowing that the pain I'm about to cause with this news and my responsibility to them, America, to take care of that family is more important than any discomfort that I have.
Jim, you write about how Marines always go out in pairs when they're delivering the bad news. Why are there two Marines going to each home?
Well, there's usually the casualty assistance calls officer plus a chaplain. I mean, nobody knows how somebody's going to react to that news. And I think they've decided that having two people there is the best way to do it. The Marines actually do it different than the Army. In the Army, they have someone who will knock on the door, and that's pretty much his job, is to deliver the news, and the family never sees him again or her again. With the Marines, that person that delivers the news is the primary casualty assistance calls officer, and they're there for the rest of the whole process.
Well, grief has many faces, and when someone's getting this shock, they respond differently, and so anger should be expected and planned for. I felt all the different emotions that they were feeling at the time, and I know the reality of it is that I'm not the person they really want to lash out at, but I'm certainly don't mind being that person, because they need to do that. They need to do that with someone, and it's better that it is me than, or the casualty assistance calls officer, than in someone else and their family or otherwise, or themselves for that matter. So taking that on is not something that we're concerned about, but we go out together. And we have a chaplain with us as well. So I think we're with another Marine and a chaplain. I don't think we can go wrong.
Jim, one of the stories that you tell in your book is the story of Catherine Caffey, who lost her husband in Iraq while she was pregnant. And it was Colonel Beck who had to deliver the news with her and who stuck with her during this horrible part of her life. Would you describe the story as you understand it of how she responded when Colonel Beck came to the door?
Sure. Catherine was actually taking a nap when they knocked at the door. And her stepfather answered. And as soon as he saw the Marines there, he knew. And then he stepped back, and Catherine's mother saw them, and she screamed. And then he went in to wake up Catherine, who had heard the screaming of her mother. And she asked what had happened, and he just said, "It's not good. You need to come outside." And as soon as she saw Major Beck and the chaplain there, she knew as well, and she started screaming. And she screamed and screamed. She ran into the other room, cradling her her pregnant, you know, belly, and and she just glared at the Marines from the way she and her parents and Major Beck describe it. And she just went and took a bath. And she sat there for a long time before she came back out. And a lot of the families have that sort of reaction of sometimes they refuse to let the Marines in, period. They say, if I don't let them in, it's not going to happen. They'll try and delay the message. But eventually, it always gets to them.
My guests are Colonel Steve Beck and journalist Jim Sheeler. For 3 years, Beck had the job of notifying families that their loved one had been killed in Iraq and then helping the families through the tough period that followed. Sheeler's new book, Final Salute, is about Beck, the families he notified, and the loved ones they lost. One of the people Sheeler writes about is Catherine Caffey, who learned from Colonel Beck that her husband Jim was killed in Iraq. She was pregnant when she got the news. Her husband's casket arrived from Iraq on a commercial airline, an American Airlines flight that landed in the Reno Tahoe International Airport. Colonel Beck, were the passengers on the flight aware that there was a fallen Marine in the cargo?
They were. What we often try to do, it doesn't always happen, but we try to make sure that we, through the help and the assistance of the airlines, we'll communicate. At least it was something that I like to do every opportunity that I had with a particular airline was to let them know to radio ahead to the pilot and ask them to ask the passengers to remain seated while we took care of our fallen Marine. And so my understanding is they were able to do that on this particular flight. They did also know that point in the war, many people realize that when there's a service member in a dress uniform on board that they may be transporting someone home. So in this particular instance, the pilot made an announcement and asked everyone to remain seated and just as we would like and show their respects as we bring our brother home.
And, Jim, you write in your book that commercial flights aren't used anymore in this way. Why did that change?
A father in California complained after learning that his son would come home on a commercial airline. And since then, Congress has passed a measure that allows the families to choose whether they want their sons to come home or sons and daughters to come home on commercial flights or on private chartered aircraft. Which in some ways is better for the family. And they've also instituted a rule that those caskets are to be met by a full honor guard and given the proper treatment.
There's an incredibly moving photo of Catherine, who was very pregnant at the time of her husband's death, draping herself over his coffin. And Jim, I know you didn't take the photographs for the book, but did you and the photographer ever feel like it was intrusive of you to be there observing or photographing this period of grief?
Well, the photo was taken by Todd Heisler, who now works for the New York Times. When we first met Catherine, it was in her home a few days after her husband's death. And she, like all the other family members, just simply wanted to talk about her husband. She wanted to tell Jim's story. And I've found this continually. It doesn't matter anybody's politics. The family wants their son or daughter's picture on the front page of the paper next day. They want their stories told. And so we sat with Catherine for hours just talking and talking. And the one thing that really struck me was she told the story of how when they found out she was pregnant, that she took up knitting because Jim was in officer candidate school at that time. And she would knit and knit. And when she found out the baby was coming, she started knitting baby blankets and baby booties. And the night before Jim left for Iraq, he slept with that baby blanket. And he did it because he knew he wouldn't be home in time to see the baby born. But when the baby was born, he wanted the baby to know how he smelled. And for me, that really said all that needed to be said about Jim Cathy as a person. And we also made a connection with Catherine. After spending hours with her during one of the worst times of her life, when we left that night, she said, thank you. You know, this may sound strange, but you guys made my night. Because we were able to take Jim's story and share it with so many people. And so when we got to Reno, it was basically the most difficult question that I had to ask in the whole reporting process was to ask Catherine if we could come along for everything, for the entire process. By this time, we had been following Major Beck for about 9 months. And but we hadn't seen everything from the inside, you know, through the family's eyes directly. And so I asked her if we could come along for everything. At that point, I probably knew more about what was going to happen than she did. But I told her that if there's ever a moment that you feel like we're getting too close, we're too intrusive, all you have to do is just wave your hand and look at us funny and we're gone. And I think by giving her that power, she realized that she didn't have to use it. It kind of created this trust that remained throughout the entire process. The night that she was sleeping with Jim's casket there, she decided to sleep with Jim's casket the very last night he was there. And at one point, just before she fell asleep, she looked up at one of the Marines who was looking over Jim's casket, and she said, "Are my reporters still here?" And he said, "Yeah, you want me to get rid of them?" And she said, "No, no, I just wanted to know that they were still here." So we were comfortable that she was comfortable with us being there and that she wanted people to see what she was seeing.
Colonel Beck, one of your jobs is to inspect the body in the casket before the family comes in and sees the body. What are you looking for in this final inspection?
Well, warfare is a very violent, is the most violent place and conditions that there are on Earth. Things happen to people that can devastate their bodies. And so it's important that we make sure that nothing has happened in transit with the airlines. And it's important that we make sure that the uniform on the Marine is perfect and so that we can convey to the family exactly what they may see if they desire to look at their loved one one final time. And so if we don't inspect that Marine, we won't understand how best to convey that information to the family so that they can make an informed decision on what their wishes might be with respect to seeing their loved one.
Have you found that most people want to see their loved one even if it was a violent death, even if the body has been mutilated by the death?
No. I haven't found it one way or another necessarily. I think opinions vary on that.
What did Catherine decide to do?
They chose not to.
Mm-hmm. Jim, you've attended about a dozen Marine funerals as part of your reporting and your research for the book. As an outsider, as a person who's a reporter, not a Marine, what did you find most interesting or most confusing to you about the actual Marine funeral rituals?
I think the most amazing things are the things that you don't see, the things that are happening behind the scenes. Yes, there's the very formal and very important ceremony where the Marines are folding that flag for the last time that so many people have seen. But at the same time, a lot of times the Marines will go to the houses, the homes of the relatives or the family members, and station themselves at the house because they know it's been in the paper that this family's not going to be at the house. So they want to have that covered, that nobody's going to rob that house, that this family's going to be taken care of. One mother just told me, the Marines are everywhere right now. You don't even know where they are. And so I've made it my job to try and find out. And it was pretty amazing to find out that the escort who brought that Marine home is there and will not leave the casket unattended. And the Marines themselves will not leave that casket anywhere where the public can get anywhere near it. There's going to be two Marines standing at the head and the foot of their brother. And just that dedication is pretty amazing. Some of the Marines that I talk to will, while they're standing post there, they'll talk to the body, even if they never knew him. They'll talk to him when they come up into the airplane and say, hello, you know, you're home. They take this very personally. And when you talk to them about the impact, it's pretty incredible. You know, they're trained to kill, really. I mean, they're trained to fight, and they know how to fight as good as anybody in any branch of the service, and yet when you talk to them about these emotions when they pick up that casket, one of them told me that you don't know, you don't understand until you pick up that casket and you feel the weight. That's when you understand.
Colonel Beck, where were you at the funerals for the loved ones of the people who you were working with after delivering the news?
I'm the person that delivers the flag to that family. And so I'm running the ceremony at the funeral. So I'm in charge of that ceremony. And so that funeral, that flag is folded by the Marines, the pallbearers there, and who carried him or her. And they fold that flag, as Jim said, for the last time. And the rifle detail puts three of the brass rounds from the rifle salute into the final fold of that flag. And they present that flag to me to present to the family.
What are some of the things you know that families have done with the flag?
Well, it varies. I've seen flags framed and prominently displayed on mantles. I've seen flags framed and displayed within other cases with all of their loved ones' Marine Corps items around it, basically paying honor to his service or her service. I've seen flags placed in drawers as keepsakes because it's not that they don't want to see them, they just want to protect them and keep them in a very secret place. That's the extent of it. I haven't seen much else.
A lot of the families will, I think I've seen this especially with families with sons who were not married and still have their childhood room. That room turns into a virtual shrine to these guys with everything they've received. It's pretty amazing what the country has done, also kind of behind the scenes. There's a group that sends a quilt to every family. There's a guy that draws a pretty incredible portrait of every service member who's died and just sends it to the family. Mm-hmm. They get stuff from everywhere, just condolence letters, piles of condolence letters, and they save them. And a lot of time they turn into these shrines, these boyhood rooms.
Catherine received a phone call, but I was trying to imagine what it was like for her when she got this call. Like after she got the news that her husband had died, she got a call that the morticians had found his leg. And what did she want them to do with it? The person on the phone gave her several options.
Yeah, I actually made that call to Catherine. And Catherine had signed, when we have incomplete remains that come home, as was the case with Jim, the next of kin has to make a decision on what they would want to happen with those remains if they were later discovered. And there are procedures in place with the government at Dover and otherwise that we can do what the family wishes. We can actually bring the casket back up and bury the recently discovered remains with the Marine, or they can make other choices. Catherine chose to have Jim's, the portion of his remains that were discovered, to actually have them placed in a urn and brought delivered to her in Colorado so that she could have a piece of Jim with her.
Colonel, are you still in touch with Catherine?
Sure.
How long ago did her husband die?
Gosh, 4 years.
So that says something about the commitment that you make to a family after delivering the news.
These families mean a great deal to me, and they all have a very special place in my heart, and I hope I have one in theirs, and they're a part of my family, so that's how I view them.
You know, I'm wondering, like, when you train to be a Marine, you're training to survive war and to be able to kill your enemy. When you're dealing with families on the home front, delivering the news that their loved one has died, and then being there to support the family through this horrible period in their lives, it's such a different set of emotions and skills and parts of yourself that you must have to draw on. Were you prepared for that? I mean, do you know what I'm saying? It's like being a Marine in war is so completely different than having to be with somebody while they're grieving and be there for them.
I completely understand. One of the things that Jim said and you've just repeated was that, you know, Marines are trained for war and they're trained to kill. That's certainly true. We're very good at that. The counter argument is we're extremely good at saving lives and taking care of people. The saying, no better friend, no worse enemy, certainly holds true for all Marines. So we're as adept at protecting lives and saving lives as we are at taking them. So, and as defenders of this country and democracy and freedom, I think that that's exactly what you want.
Is it fair to say, because this is the impression, one of the impressions I took away from the book, that you both feel that Americans have been very protected from the realities of the war in Iraq, that the men and women fighting in Iraq and their families and loved ones have paid a huge price, are making incredible sacrifices, but that the majority of Americans have been protected from those sacrifices and haven't been really called on to make sacrifices. Am I interpreting that correctly? And if so, would you elaborate on your concerns about that?
Well, I think the sacrifice is the right word. I've especially seen it in the, the homes of these wives and widows who've, you know, the stories come out in the beginning, and the first funeral we had in Colorado, thousands of people lined the streets, and now, unless it's a smaller town, really the turnout is relatively small. You see that name go across the TV screen, and for anybody who's had any involvement in the process, it weighs so much heavier. I mean, that name is going to affect tens, if not hundreds, of people, including the service member who just got that cell phone call and had to go knock on that door, which could be happening right now. And the people, there's so many people in this country that live with that realization that that knock could be coming anytime. And yet they go and they do their jobs and they take their kids. The kids are trying to make it through school. I interviewed a girl who got in trouble, sent to the principal's office for writing on the bathroom mirror in lipstick, "What do you do when your mom's in Iraq?" You know, there's these little scenes that are happening everywhere. And just helping people understand that there is a war going on. I think that there's no family out there who would be against that.
Jim, you're a young journalist at kind of the beginning of your career, and you've spent, 5 years writing about fallen soldiers and fallen Marines and their families, and you've written a lot of other obituaries as well. One of the stories you tell is about a Marine who'd been a gravedigger at Fort Logan Cemetery, a military cemetery. And he had been promoted to a supervisory position. Now, he had been sent to Iraq, and when he got back, suffered a terrible depression. It sounded like he was nearly suicidal. And you write about how the place that he seemed to feel most comfortable was working in the cemetery. Would you talk a little bit about what he told you about that?
Sure. His name is Andrew Alonzo, and he's a reservist who saw one of his really good friends die in Iraq and came back and had a really hard time. He was actually a caretaker at the cemetery when he was called up to go to Iraq. So he had been burying mostly World War II veterans, Vietnam veterans, and then he came back after Iraq and was basically in charge of setting the headstones for the newest active duty, especially the Marines who were coming back. And he had an incredibly hard time with it in the beginning, but then he realized that being that last person to take care of those guys was actually a very cathartic thing for him, that that he could make sure that they were cared for. And as we were standing there, as one of the Marines was being buried, he kind of stood off on the side, and after the family left, I asked him what he would have said to her. And he said he felt awkward going up and talking to her, but if he would have could have talked to her, he would have told her that it's okay. We'll take care of him now.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Colonel Steve Beck and journalist Jim Sheeler. Sheeler's new book is called Final Salute. You can download podcasts of our interviews on our website, freshair.npr.org. Willie Nelson turns 75 today, and to honor him, Little Brown is releasing a major biography called Willie Nelson, An Epic Life by Joe Nick Petoskey. And Sony Legacy has issued a 4-disc box set that spans Nelson's entire career. Our rock historian, Ed Ward, has seen Nelson in concert and interviewed him many times and has even helped sing backup vocals on one of his albums. Today, Ed looks at Willie Nelson, the songwriter, whose career preceded Willie Nelson, the superstars, by a couple of decades.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends. And I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again.
This is the Willie Nelson most of America knows. Picking his old Martin guitar, accompanied by his ragtag band, rolling down the highway in a cloud of pot smoke, outlaw country music in person. But the Willie Nelson I first became aware of in the early 1970s was someone else entirely, a Nashville songwriter with a unique lyrical and musical gift. William Hugh Nelson was born in Abbott, Texas in 1933 to a musically inclined couple, Ira and Merle Nelson, who already had a 3-year-old daughter, Bobby. Abbott's cotton country, and there's not much to do there, so Bobby learned piano, and Willie was writing poems by the time he was 4 years old. Mostly, they were sad, maybe because his mother had left when he was 6 months old and his father wasn't around much. When Bobby was 16, she married a guy named Bud Fletcher, who had a Western swing band. She played piano, and 13-year-old Willie signed on to play guitar, and almost immediately he had a fan club. He fell into the life of a professional musician and made his first recordings as a guitar player in 1954 in San Antonio. He had a job as a disc jockey there and used the studio to record a song of his own.
Broke the heart of my darling who loved me. Broke her heart, I know I done wrong. But I pray that someday she'll forgive me and remember when I've sang my last hillbilly song. When I've sang my last hillbilly song.
It wasn't much of a song, but the voice is recognizable. The record company he sent it to ignored it for a few decades, and Willie went on to DJ in Fort Worth next. From there, he drifted to Portland, Oregon, where he did more radio and gigged as a musician. Somehow, he came to the attention of Nashville songwriter May Boren Axton, who encouraged him to move down there, but he ran out of money on the road and wound up back in Fort Worth. There, he made a record for the Houston-based D Records label, which did well enough that he was allowed a second one. The label decided it wasn't country enough and refused to release it, so Willie and a friend released it under another name. It was the beginning of Willie Nelson, the songwriter.
Mm-hmm. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue. I knew that you'd love me as long as you wanted. And then someday you'd leave me for somebody new.
If anything would warn Nashville that this young songwriter wouldn't fit in, this was it. But Crazy has proven one of Willie's most durable songs, thanks to a country pop crossover by Patsy Cline. After Willie wrote a song called Family Bible and sold it for $100, and it became a smash country hit for Claude Gray, Pamper Music offered him a contract, and he moved to Nashville. Hit after hit for others followed. Nightlife, Hello Walls, Funny How Time Slips Away. Because he was such a valuable hit writer, record companies wanted him as an artist because the publishing deal they'd strike with him would mean income for their bigger stars. Finally, in 1964, he signed with Nashville's most prestigious label, RCA, but not much happened. He'd put together a band with some of his Texas buddies, Johnny Bush, Jimmy Day on steel guitar, and drummer Paul English. But as one of his most famous songs from these years shows, the road wasn't that much fun either.
It's been rough and rocky traveling, but I'm finally standing upright on the ground. After taking several readings, I'm surprised to find my mind still fairly sound. I guess Nashville was the roughest, but I know I've said the same about them all. We received our education in the cities of the nation, me and Paul.
In 1970, Willie's Nashville house burned down, and he moved to the hill country just outside Austin, Texas, more depressed than he'd ever been. A year later, he recorded The Words Don't Fit the Picture, an album so dark that it barely sold and has never been reissued.
If this is a game we play, and if this is a role I play, where are the words I say to you? The words don't fit the picture anymore.
Just when it seemed Willie had hit bottom, things turned around. He played a gig at an automobile dealership's opening in Austin and noticed hippies in the crowd. When the local psychedelic dance hall, Armadillo World Headquarters, asked him if he'd like to do a show, he agreed. Odd songwriters began approaching him with distinctly Texan songs they'd written and were performing in small local clubs. Willie had found his people, and in 1973, he celebrated the 4th of July with a small rock festival where a lot of these people played. His RCA contract ran out, and he signed with Atlantic Records, where he made a concept album, Phases and Stages, that was a masterpiece, but the record company closed its country division before it could become a hit. From there, he went to Columbia Records in 1975, and in a week, he recorded another concept album, Redheaded Stranger, which contained his first hit, Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain. Willie became famous, and the more famous he became, the fewer songs he wrote, which really was fine. Those songs had been unutterably sad, and now Willie Nelson was happy.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Today is Willie Nelson's 75th birthday. Ed Ward's 75th birthday tribute to Willie Nelson left us wanting to hear more, so we're going to listen back to an excerpt of the interview and performance Nelson recorded on Fresh Air in 1996, in which he played one of his best-known songs.
Now, the guitar you have with you, is that your guitar Trigger?
Yes, it is.
Tell us about the guitar.
Well, the guitar's about 30 years old or so, and it's my favorite guitar. I like it because of the tone.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of shape is it in after 30 years?
Oh, it's in a little better shape than I am. It survived pretty good, really. Uh-huh. It's got a couple of holes that were larger than they were in the beginning, but we all do, I guess.
Do the holes affect the sound?
I think it improves the sound, really. This guitar already has one huge hole in the middle. Now it's got another one growing in the back there, which sort of looks pretty neat.
Some people might think of getting stuff like that repaired.
Oh, they might, but I think it'd be a mistake. Now it does disintegrate on the inside. The wood is rotted away a couple of times, and I've had to rebuild it and have it rebuilt and reinforced in there. But the hole, it just keeps getting bigger, and as it does, the sound gets a little better. I don't know if you've noticed it or not.
I think it was before you went to Nashville that you wanted to record your song Nightlife. Mm-hmm. And one of the producers you were working with at the time, Pappy Daly, told you that you weren't country enough. Do I have that right?
Actually, I recorded in Houston for Pappy Daly, who had a company called, it was Glad Publishing Company, D Records for Daly. And I recorded Family Bible on that label and recorded a couple of other songs. But Nightlife, they wouldn't record it because they said it was too bluesy. It wasn't country. Mm-hmm. So I recorded Nightlife under the name of Hugh Nelson on another label across town, just to prove a point.
And did you prove it?
Yeah. It's that particular record, Nightlife, I think it's still the best record of it. I did it with Paul Buskirk, Herb Remington, Dean Reynolds, some of the greatest jazz and musicians around Houston.
Would you sing the song for us now and maybe tell us about writing it?
Well, this is one of those songs that I wrote the same week I wrote Crazy and Funny How Time Slips Away, driving back and forth from the Esquire Club to Pasadena every night. When the evening sun goes down, you will find me hanging round the nightlife. Ain't no good life, but it's my life. Many people just like me, dreaming of old used to be. Nightlife ain't no good life, but it's my life. Listen to the blues they're playing. And listen to what the blues are saying. Mine is just another scene from the world of broken dreams. And the nightlife ain't no good life, but it's my life.
What was your nightlife like when you wrote that?
I don't remember.
As if to prove a point.
Yeah.
Willie Nelson recorded on Fresh Air in 1996. We wish him a happy 75th birthday.
Oh, it's all your fault if I'm not sleeping. I live on dreams instead of eating, and I'm just a wreck. It's all your fault.
fault. Oh, it's all your fault if I'm not playing and having fun, and if I'm staying all by myself, well, it's all your fault. And when you said that we were through, I tried to find somebody new, but I found out that wouldn't do, 'cause I'd rather be alone than with somebody new. It's all your fault when I'm a grandpa, if my grandkids don't call you grandma, well, I'll just tell them it's all your fault.